Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Russ Chianelli. And today we're, in a sense, going to do a follow-up to a program we did with Ben Evans. If you remember Ben, he was the evolutionary geneticist, was very interested in frogs, their demise. Well, today we're going to have someone that, in fact, has a museum background. He's sort of a collections person, and part of the collection is going to be associated with models of frogs. Russ, who's the guest?
We're very happy to welcome to Science Studio John Simmons, and he's the president of Museo Logica, which is in Belfonte, Pennsylvania. Welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, it's a great pleasure to have you here, John, and look forward to this fascinating sort of story. But before we get to, you know, the meaty part, let's find out a little bit about the beginnings of your career. What put you into this sort of final career?
I was one of those fortunate kids whose parents drug them to museums and national parks on trips around the U.S. all the time. So I was interested in museums from the time I was very small. When I was 13, I built my own natural history museum in the family basement. I found this wonderful book called How to Make a Home Nature Museum by Vincent Brown, and this became the book I lived by. So I had exhibits and collections and all of this, and it followed naturally that I began collecting snakes and frogs in junior high, and by the time I got to college, I landed a job in a laboratory where they studied amphibians and reptiles, and the die was cast.
Yeah, I think you trained well, right?
As an undergraduate, I spent a couple of years in South America. I lived in the Amazon, traveled quite a bit. And then I went to work for a zoo, Fort Worth Zoological Park, as a keeper in the reptile house, and then was at California Academy of Sciences as a collection manager, and then at University of Kansas in the Natural History Museum for 26 years as a collection manager, and finally as director of their museum studies program.
Wow. I mean, that's some career. Now, just let me go back to the part when you're about 14, bringing home snakes and the like. These were alive, presumably.
Oh, yes, they were. Yeah. Yeah, I started snake collecting actually when I was much younger, much to my parents' chagrin. I grew up in Fort Worth. I'm from Fort Worth, Texas.
Right.
And there was a family ranch in Bosque County where my cousins and I used to spend a lot of time. And the time that it became obvious to my parents they had a problem was I was out one day. We all piled out of the truck, and my cousins went off to look at cows. And I began flipping over rocks, and this old rancher that was there said, "Hey, boy," he says, "you're going to find a snake if you aren't careful." And I said, "I'm looking for them." And that was when my mom realized we got an issue.
But did you ever have a close call with one?
How close would you like?
I don't know. I mean,
anyone that works with snakes probably has a few close calls. I've never been bitten by anything dangerous, but I've been next to people who were bitten.
What did you do? Just sit
down
and
suck out? I was glad it wasn't me. We actually had a snake bite in a lab I worked in, and an animal keeper who was quite experienced got a couple of just scratches across the back of two fingers from a diamondback, and we had him at the hospital within 10 minutes. He was under the care of a doctor who knew how to treat snake bite, and he wound up losing a couple of joints off one finger and one joint off another and receiving 15 vials of anavenine. It was a very, very serious bite, but for what looked like a scratch.
I was expecting you say you cut off his finger and sucked out the poison.
It wasn't that good a friend. that is an old treatment, but not what's recommended. What they recommend now for a snake bite almost anywhere that you would add happen in the United States is get to a hospital immediately. Don't try any of these heroic measures of sucking out the venom or anything.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's fine for people to say, but I mean, a lot of snakes just sort of inhabit places where there aren't hospitals around the corner.
This is true.
Right.
But
so it's a nice concept.
Well, it's an interesting question, too, because what did the settlers do then? They had some cures and attempts.
There's a lot of question as to whether actually trying to suck venom out of a wound will in fact do any good. You know, a lot of snake bites are dry bites. Estimates in the United States are that it's probably as high as 30 or 35% of venomous bites. There's no venom injected. And this is one of the reasons these folkloric measures have persisted
So 30% of the time you're going to be successful.
That's right. They seem to work so many times. So drink a quart of whiskey, do all these other things. They all seem to work.
What's the point about a snake biting and not using its venom? Does it have any control over that?
Well, you know, a snake uses venom when it's hunting, and this is a way to kill the prey item, but also it's a way to start feeding because venom is a modified saliva, and so they are digesting the prey item with the thing. If a snake bites you and kills you, by the time you're dead, the snake's probably dead too because you've probably killed it. So it's not a terribly good defensive mechanism. It's a kind of a last resort. So it is thought that a lot of snakes probably save their venom for feeding later, but they bite as that warning. It doesn't do them a lot of good to waste venom on an animal they can't eat.
So only fiddle with snakes when they look satiated with food. Well, let's talk about Museologica. What is Museologica?
It's a private company I set up to work as a consultant, and I help museums with collections issues. I do everything from helping write policy and do planning down to actual physical rehousing of specimens. I work with a lot of anatomical museums housing human body parts and museums talking about how they can work with their collections. I do a lot of training, teaching, workshops.
So what's the real issue? I mean, you think that the museum...
The issue is I like to travel.
Well, no, I got your issue, but theirs. I mean, if they've already got a museum with parts and exhibits, what is it that you go in and show them how to do it properly?
Even though museums have been around for about 300 years, there are still a lot of things that we don't do right and that can be improved. And I go in and look at situations and try to help people find better solutions. I can give you an example if you want.
Yeah, please.
Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago has had an exhibit up since the 1930s called the Human Body Slice Exhibit. And these are some sagittal and transverse sections through human bodies, very popular with the public. Almost everyone in Chicago saw these as a kid at some point. And you ask any cab driver, do you know the body slices? Oh, yeah, I went there in third grade. These were
like
exhibited.
The mummies in Guanajuato.
Exactly. So these were exhibited for years in glass containers, and they were fine. But back in the 70s, the museum switched them over to plexiglass containers, so acrylic containers, which a lot of anatomy museums switched to these because they were less expensive. They could make them in-house. They could make custom shapes. And over the years, the exhibit got to looking really bad. And so I was called in about 10 years ago to look at this exhibit because it was very hard to see the specimens. The acrylic looked terrible. It looked like the specimens had faded out to the point they were thinking about getting rid of them. And the problem wasn't the specimens. It was the plastic because acrylic allows alcohol and formaldehyde to pass through. It's absorbent. And with that, it carries the dissolved fats that are in alcohol, and it discolored. And then as the alcohol dissolves through, you get negative pressure inside the containers. With temperature changes, the acrylic flexes in and out and gets these little stress cracks in it. So they merely had an exhibit problem they didn't know they had. What we did was a complete redesign. We got borosilicate glass, which is a very expensive glass. It's poured out in a sheet of molten lead – or molten tin, rather, so there's no mold markings at all on it. It has great optical properties. This was had this glued together with a high-tech epoxy. It has great light transmission properties. We put these specimens in, and they look like they're new. It's
yeah,
fabulous.
But I mean, your initial point was that they did it because of economics.
They did it because of economics, and they didn't know what was going on.
You solved the problem by making it more expensive.
Well, yes. The initial thing was done for economics, but the thing was these are important specimens to preserve. It is parts of two human bodies. You need to have respect
where did they,
for
how old
these
are they?
Things.
Did they clear the missing persons search? Closed cases?
The bodies were prepared by a doctor at a local hospital for a World's Fair back in the 30s. And so these were acquired through the hospital. But, you know, the point is these are things that are worth saving. They're icons in the city of Chicago. They still are very educational for people coming through to look at. We do need to respect human body parts in museums. And this enabled people to see these much, much better. But it's a modern solution to a problem of these.
We had to clean them up too, didn't you? You said
they
didn't.
We did. We pulled them out of the cases. We cleaned each one very carefully with cotton swabs and washed them down. We remounted them on glass backing plates. It was a fairly extensive operation, but it looks great.
You say we. Is this something you physically do, or you have a team that they
do
this?
In this case, I did the work with staff members from the museum.
So if you do it right, that means, from what I'm hearing, glass, good glass, formaldehyde, nothing leaking in or leaking out. How long would it actually last, something like that?
The oldest specimens that we have are about 350 years old, and those were specimens that were preserved in England back in the 1600s. And not a lot of the old specimens have lasted, but
you
enough.
You mean like Anne Boleyn's head or something like that?
No, fluid preservation started on, I can actually give you the date, it's the 4th of June of 1663. And we know that because on that date, a doctor by the name of William Croon appeared before the Royal Society and showed two dog embryos that he had put in what was then called spirit of wine, ethyl alcohol, in a glass vial and sealed them up. And that became caught on very quickly. Robert Boyle became very interested, the British scientist, and he did some experimentation. He was the first to propose preserving a human in alcohol. And the tradition got started there. And so a lot of these older specimens, unfortunately not Croon's, but some almost that old, have been preserved. And so some of the European museums have specimens that are that old. As to how long they'll last, we don't know. There's no reason we shouldn't expect 500 or 1,000 years out of these specimens if they're properly cared for.
as I alluded to at the beginning, you've got some connection here with amphibians that we know are rapidly disappearing because of certain diseases that they have and also because of loss of habitat and change of habitat. Tell us a little bit about your interactions in that field.
Yeah, well, I was fortunate to do my undergraduate degree at University of Kansas, where there were a number of people working on amphibians. And I wound up, after working in a couple of other places, getting offered a job there as collections manager in the Division of Herpetology, which is the study of amphibians and reptiles in the museum. And so I was around a lot of people working on issues with amphibians and reptiles. I did a lot of field work in South America where things are going extinct at a very rapid rate. So this is a long interest that I've had. One of the more interesting aspects of this was I was contacted by an artist in Dallas, Texas, a number of years ago named Tracy Hicks. He's an artist, but he's always been fascinated by frogs. He's very concerned about disappearing frogs, so he made a decision to devote half of his studio space to raising poison dart frogs. And he decided to incorporate these into his art. And he had developed a cold casting technique for making cast of scientific specimens. What he wanted to do was bring the specimens out of the collections that weren't seen by the public and put them on display. And he had seen these at University of Texas in Arlington. And so he contacted me and came up and demonstrated his technique. And it had a technique that did not cause damage to the specimens, and we ultimately were able to mount a very large-scale exhibit there by getting Asian amphibians from Chicago, from the Field Museum, and the New World amphibians from Kansas, and Tracy made up 1,700 jars of silicon cast of amphibians from scientific collections. He rubbed them with powders to make them glow in the dark and put them in various colored oils and alcohols. When you walked in, it looked at first glance like a typical museum collection of jars and jars of specimens. But when you look closer, these things would glow and they would fade out when the lights were turned out. But you could go to any particular jar in the exhibit and ask Tracy what the frog was, and he could look it up in his database because he had all the scientific records that went along with the amphibians. And he primarily made cast of things that were endangered or extinct, but he did a few others that just made interesting shapes. And he has pursued this work quite a bit. His last installation was in Dayton, Ohio. It was an exhibit called Evolution. And this is for the anniversary of the birth of Charles Darwin that incorporated skeletons and a lot of other things
into
it.
Is that the exhibit with the frogs that have been sort of impregnated with different fluorescent materials?
Those were included. Yeah.
Yeah, but is that still extant? You can see it somewhere
today?
It is
available on Tracy's website, which is www.tracyhicks.com. He does sell some of the jars as well.
So he sort of disassembled it after a while.
It was disassembled. It had been reassembled since then in a couple of other exhibits. Yeah. Each one changes a little bit. Being an artist, he's always putting energy into this. And what Tracy wants to do is draw attention to these amphibians, but he also wants to show people how beautiful scientific collections are. The scientists are the ones who usually are the last to see this because we see these things as sources of information, of tools that we work with day to day to understand biodiversity. And we often fail to see the beauty of them. But, you know, collections are cultural products. They're made by people that have cultural and social constraints on the way they think. They're asking particular scientific questions, getting particular answers, and we often get so hung up in that we forget to look at
them. You know, it's interesting because we're all concerned here now at the university that less and less people are going into science and engineering and so on. And I had the same experience with my grandparents or somebody taking me to a museum, and that's where the interest was triggered. Are we doing a poor job with the kids? Or can we do a better job?
We can do a better job. It's interesting how many people can trace their first introduction to science back to a memory of going into a museum, some scientist taking the time to talk to them individually or maybe do a presentation for a group.
Well, Russ's career, for example, you know, you see color that turn you on.
And almost all of us have some moment we can look to and say, that was when it opened up my eyes. That was when things really changed for me. I just took my 5-year-old granddaughter to see the collections at Lincoln, Nebraska, because she loves dinosaurs and bones in particular. This is a 5-year-old who has her own possum skeleton that she keeps in a shoebox. I wanted her to have that same experience of going in and seeing these vast amounts of skeletons and talking to a real paleontologist.
You're listening to Science Studio, Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, John Simmons. And we'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Neisel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. Most of us don't realize that when a surgeon cuts into a patient to remove a cancerous tumor, it's not easy to distinguish between healthy and cancer cells.
Sure, they're guided by MRIs and CT scans that show them where the cancer tissues are, but those images are static, no matter how clear they are. Once the surgeon makes the incision and goes in, reality hits.
The body is dynamic, and tumor growth can have irregular borders. Identifying exact margins of the cancer tissue when cells are mere microns in size, that's thousands of a millimeter, is daunting.
Well, last time I checked, bionic eyes aren't available yet. So the standard of care is to cut a larger swath into healthy tissue to ensure all the tumor cells are removed. But something better is being developed. Cancer goggles, a surgeon would wear to identify tumor cells during the surgery.
First, the patient is injected with a dye that binds to cancer cells. The dye specifically binds to a number of different cancer cells, such as prostate, colon, breast, and liver tumor cells. When hit with an infrared light, they glow.
This allows the surgeon to cut away until all the glowing cells are removed. In the lab, the dye remained just long enough for an operation to finish, and theoretically, the patient could be injected with a dye just before the procedure.
The cancer goggles are being tried out in veterinary clinics first, and if they work, cancer patients could avoid having healthy tissues removed. More importantly, they could avoid repeat surgeries to remove tumors that have regrown from missed cells.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio, Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, John Simmons, and we're talking about museums, artifacts, use of material science to better exhibit these museum pieces, amphibians. We're losing amphibians left, right, and center. So let's carry on the conversation. Russ, you have a question.
When you set up a museum, you have a purpose. And again, the question about how can we do better? Have we lost something with our youth?
I think museums, especially in their public presentation, have had this tendency to become distracted from what is the key component of a museum. They've been subject to wanting to include television monitors and now computer stations, a lot of interactive exhibits that really don't teach people much to give people more things to do. They've tried to compete with TV and theme parks. The recent survey work that's been done on museums and museum education has shown that the reason people go to museums is to see real things. People line up for blocks to see the actual thing when they can find a program about it on TV because they like to see it. There was a fear when museums first began doing virtual exhibits that, well, everyone will just look at the internet at the museum and not visit. And in fact, virtual exhibits increase membership because people want to go see that real thing with themselves. If you exhibit a stovepipe hat, you might get a few people looking at it. If you exhibit Abraham Lincoln's stovepipe hat, you'll have a line out the door. And I think this is one thing that museums need to refocus on, bringing the actual objects out of the collections and putting those before people and giving them a little context to understand those objects and why they're important, why they're in the museum.
Yeah, I was surprised. It was in a museum, I think it was in Cleveland, and there were so many things, toys, games to play with, you know, make the magnet go up and this and that. And I found it quite distracting.
In museum education, there is a term for what happens when children enter a museum like that. It's called the pinball effect.
Yeah.
Because they run from one interactive to another, flipping the levers and lifting
exactly.
The doors, learning nothing. You know, the way people learn in museums is varied, and it depends on your age and your background. But we make connections to things we already know. Some people learn by reading labels. Some people learn by talking to their companions. Some learn by sitting and looking. Some learn by just looking at the object themselves and not reading anything. There's all kinds of ways to learn, and museums should structure their exhibits to provide all of those different ways of learning, and especially get things down on levels where everyone can see them, where children can see them. And if you do want to have an interactive, have it a meaningful interactive where you actually learn something by doing the motions. I just saw a fabulous one. I was in Leiden last spring at their National Natural History Museum called Naturalia, and they had an exhibit of wildebeests, and there was a video machine, a video screen displaying wildebeest hunting. And the kids had to be the lion. They had to get down on indoor-outdoor carpeting and crawl along. And if they raised their head, they triggered an electric eye beam and flashed a warning on the screen. The wildebeest have seen you. The next time it warned you that the wildebeest were now very scared. And if you got your head up a third time, the wildebeest stampeded off the screen. But one kid made it, stuck to the ground so tight he actually scratched his face and was bleeding. Got all the way up to the front and there was a red button you were supposed to push. So I wondered, what happens when they get there? The kid acted like the lion. He slunk up. He got to the red button, slammed his fist on the red button, and it printed out a receipt for his wildebeest, explaining what a wildebeest is, how many wildebeest the lions eat, nutritional value, and all that. That was a great interaction.
Oh, it sounds wonderful.
But unfortunately, they tend to be far more open the door and see something and drop it or pull it.
You know,
it
but you know, thinking about your experience, my own experience, it was staring through this glass, looking at something, and it was quiet. And I could stand there as long as I wanted until my grandmother pulled me along or something. But there was something about that silence and being able to look at this stuff.
That's actually what hooked me to were dioramas. My earliest museum memory are dioramas. The seeing these things in miniature or life size, either one, but that frozen moment because you can see things you can't see when things are moving. And yeah, that ability to look at every detail. I agree. That's what hooked me. But it's not necessarily what hooks everyone. And that's why I think a variety of these things should be shown. But they should always feature real objects.
Now, you also said something that I wondered about, too. You said that museums were 300 years old. And thinking about that, I imagine that maybe the Romans had museums or the Egyptians had museums, maybe in a different sense.
But collections go back a long way.
So there's a difference between a collection and a museum.
It depends on how you want to define museum. Collections go back a long way. We have found collections in Babylonia with cuneiform labels. Collections of antiquities. And there were collections all through history. The Chinese kept collections. Thutmose III had huge collections. Solomon had collections. But if you want to look at a museum, to me, is really an association of an object and learning. And in that sense, the first true museum was probably the Temple of the Muses, which is where we get the word museum, in ancient Alexandria, about 300 BC, because that brought together the teachers and objects. And there were art objects and natural history things brought together in the Library of Alexandria for teaching purposes. And I think that's the model museums were built on. The first real museums, though, don't appear until the Renaissance when you had the cabinets of curiosities. And that was, again, this association of objects and learning. And in that case, the main purpose in those museums, you talk about museum purpose, was collect objects from the natural world that are unusual. And the reason for that is to understand the divine order in the universe, understand how the mind of God works, if you will, understand how these things work. And our modern museums come directly from those cabinets. You can see a steady progressive evolution of cabinets of curiosity through the Ashmolean, the first public museum, Oxford. Which is in Oxford, and up through our modern museums. You know, it's interesting that when James Smithson left his fortune to the United States, a country he had never visited, he left it for the purpose of diffusing knowledge. So he wanted knowledge to expand and be diffused through the American public. And Congress debated that for a number of years. And, well, how do we do this? They talked about a Smithson University. They talked about a Smithson Library. And ultimately, they hit upon the thing that worked, the Smithsonian Institution, build a museum to diffuse knowledge through the public.
Do you have private collection? I mean, you've been around the world. You've been down in America.
Like everyone else working in museums, yes, I cannot control that collecting urge. My weakest part is books. I have way too many books. Well, there are no such thing as too many books, but I have more than I can house.
Right.
And I tend to collect a little odd things here and there besides the books, but I don't collect natural history objects because that would be an ethical problem since I do work with natural history collections, but I do collect other things.
Well, just go run through that for the audience. Where do you perceive the ethical issue there?
In museum codes of ethics, and most American museum professionals follow the code of the American Association of Museums. Most others use the code for ICOM, the International Committee on Museums of UNESCO. Those codes both say that museum professionals should not collect in the area that they work in because of the conflict of interest potential, that you want an object but your museum wants the same object, and this might override your objective ability to get that object for your museum. You might want to keep it for yourself. So museum professionals rarely collect in the area of their own study. For instance, if you go to an art museum, most of the curators will have an art collection at home, but it will not be their area of expertise. If the area of expertise is Renaissance prints, they probably collect turquoise jewelry.
So that would put them in conflict.
Avoid the conflict or the appearance of conflict. Okay. And that's very important if you're an institution that works, as museums do, in the public trust, where you are holding these collections in trust for the public. You want to make sure that your behavior is above board.
In your travels, though, you must come across the possibility of a sample.
Oh, the temptations are horrendous.
Well, no, not the temptation for yourself, but now, given what you've just described to us, the temptation to say, well, I bet the museum in Nebraska or somewhere would love to have this. Do you do that at all? Are you a purveyor of samples?
Oh, I have. In the past, I have collected things for museums, but as you say, is it legal is the big issue.
Right.
It is very difficult. When I started out collecting back in the 70s, most places you could collect without getting any kind of special permission or permits. That's not true anymore. Almost everything you would want to collect for a museum, antiquities, art, natural history, requires permits, export permits, import, ownership. And unless you have all the paperwork in line, you should not collect things for museums. And in most cases, you want to know that the museum, in fact, wants that object before you collect it. It's a real burden on museums to have people just bring them things and say, here, I got this for you, without asking whether that's appropriate for the museum collection or not.
You know, it's an interesting point because here in El Paso, we're in a region that's surrounded with artifacts, Native American artifacts. And I was told by an archaeologist friend that when you find one, especially if it's on state territory, you must leave it there where it's found. You could report it, but you can't take it.
Yeah, on state land, that's true. Private land, you do have the right to pick it up, but you may, in fact, be taking away information from that object because the minute you pick it up, you take it out of context. A lot of surface finds don't have a very good context because you don't know where they came from. They may have washed in. But in general, the best thing to do is definitely report that and check with someone before you pick it up. But state and federal lands, there are very strict laws regarding collecting ethnographic objects. And there are laws regulating collecting fossils and almost all living plants and animals on federal lands as well. And the last thing you want to do is discourage children from loving collections. And
exactly.
What you need is a good balance. You need to make sure people understand the difference in public land and private land. Mm-hmm. And you need to have programs that tell them what they can collect and can't collect and how it should be done right.
Right. Tell me, I just want to go back to your books. Mm-hmm. These are books only in English, or you just collect all the books that you think have got some historic and value to you?
I collect books of use to me. And so I have a fairly large collection of books on amphibians and reptiles, a lot of books about the history of museums, museum preparation. Then I do a lot of reading in Spanish and English. So I collect things I like that either will be useful to me or just books that I like. Occasionally I will buy a book because it is so beautifully made, I can't resist not having that book.
Right. And then, of course, it lands up in your basement surrounded by other books, so you can't actually see it very often. If it's anything like my book,
yes,
quote-unquote, collection.
That does get to be a problem. I am married to another bibliophile, and we went out one day to buy more bookshelves and spent the entire day out shopping, came home and realized we had purchased no bookshelves, but we did come home with five more books.
Lots more books.
So.
Well, thank you very much, John. It's a great pleasure to have you here. And
thank you.
Yes, thanks very much. Please come back to Science Studio. And thanks to Norma Martinez, who I realize is behind a glass window. There's no formaldehyde in there, is there?
We'll be back next week. Bye-bye. Thank you.
I'm Nomi Rojas with your Synapse Flash. Sierra Providence East Medical Center will build a freestanding 24/7 emergency room in Horizon City. It is an $8 million investment anticipated to create 30 to 50 new jobs. The ER is slated for completion by early 2015. Read more and see a rendering of the new facility at mcasynapse.org. Support for Synapse comes from Kindred Hospital.